course, quantum mechanics in the classroom. I've been using, of course, like every instructor, various interpretations, analogies, all kinds of pedagogical instruments in order to make the things more palatable to the students. When in cases in which I had a very class of very bright students, here is the analogy that worked best. Every time that you don't look at the photon, it does na 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 na, and then goes both ways, violates locality, conservation laws, and so on. The moment you say what and turn to it, it says kidding, and then stops in one side, and then behaves quite classically. For some reason, that analogy made students understand much better the logic of the quantum world. And of course, this looking at the quantum would be an anathema to most physicists who would still like to preserve some of the cherished classical world in this quantum mechanics, you know. So my approach is that it is the Romans who say that knowledge gives power, but it is, I believe, Orwell who said that ignorance gives even greater power. Whenever you don't know where the photon is, the photon itself does not know where it is, and then that ignorance is going to give you much power, as I'm going to show. Now, this is an anathema to many people, and of course to this guy. During all the years in which he was quarreling with his friends, then, you know, is quantum mechanics complete, incomplete, and so on and so on. Among all the looks of Yakir, he can sometimes be amused, sometimes annoyed, sometimes angry. There is one look which intimidates me most, and this is the bored look. Oh, here you go again. Let's talk about it another time. And sometimes I felt that Yakir was giving those two giants this kind of bored look. Why bother? Both of you are correct. Of course, Einstein is correct that when you consider the information coming from the past, it's absolutely incomplete. There are so many things which are missing. Of course, Bohr is correct, because when information comes from the future, then you get a complete picture. But then it's interesting. This is not the kind of barren complementarity which Bohr was giving us, in which you shouldn't be worried about all kinds of contradictions. On the contrary, this kind of rich information gives you what looks to be a contradictory picture, but then this is Yakir's next mission to teach you how to understand it and show that the quantum world is much richer, much more powerful, and enables you to do things that you did not imagine. So here is a case which is an example of this. You know the quantum liar, paradox from the New Testament. Epimenides of Crete says that all Cretans are liars. Here is a case in which nature is caught, so to speak, blushing while contradicting itself. That is, that the contradiction does not come between quantum mechanics and relativity or Newtonian mechanics, but somehow quantum mechanics seems to tell you a story which you can't make, apparently you can't make sense of. Here you have an excited atom. That exciton is bound to emit a photon within the time uncertainty. So you wait, and then you put it in a cavity just in order to make sure that the photon goes in a certain direction. Gedanken. So please don't talk to me about all kind of technical details, what happens, tails, and so on and so on. Gedanken, then later experimentalists, I'm sure, will help us with that. Now you put another cavity in which there is a ground atom. And you wait for the time in which there is the state of the excited atom is now in a superposition, excited ground, plus the time it takes for that photon to go to the other cavity, such that now the ground photon, the initially ground atom, is in a superposition of ground excited. Remember, ignorance gives power. If you don't know their states, they don't know it either, and now they are not only superposed but entangled. Which means that if you prepare many such pairs like that, within the time before they decay and so on, and give an ensemble of such pairs to Alice and Bob, then they can do the following. They can choose one out of two or three measurements to perform on each atom and making the decision at the last moment. So they can measure whether it is excited or ground, which is a superposition, and then they can measure, say, a linear excited plus ground, which would amount to the magnetic moment, or excited minus ground. So then they have these three measurements, just like in the ordinary EPR experiment. They choose at the last moment, get the results, either up or down, or this way or that way, excited or ground, and then when they compare the results, just as Bell obliged, it turns out that something fishy was going on. That is, that something non-local, the very choice, the very decision of Alice or Bob, which of the three measurements to choose, was determined plus the result, determined the result up or down or excited ground of Bob or Alice, which is very nice until you recall that in some of the cases, what they chose and what they had to choose, if they do it randomly, is to measure whether the atom is excited or ground rather than its magnetic moment. And in some cases, actually, in half of the cases in which this is the measurement that they chose, Alice may find out that the atom which was excited has remained excited. And in half of these cases, it is Bob who chose to measure also, just by chance, his atom, and turns out that his atom, which was ground, has remained ground. Or he may choose another thing, which is somewhat strange, because that means that no photon was exchanged. Here is information coming from the future. You have information coming from the past, which tells you that they should be entangled. But here, in these cases, information comes from the future and tells you that no photon was ever exchanged between them. However, if Alice has measured for excited ground and found that her excited atom has remained excited, and at that time Bob has chosen magnetic moment, which is a superposition of these two, he finds a correlation. And of course, we know for sure, this is Einstein's element of reality, that if he chooses also at that time, by chance, to measure excited or ground, he will get ground, so no photon was exchanged between them. Why do I feel that something here doesn't make sense? Remember Ephraim's scheme of ripping off a miserable tourist through his quantum game. Now imagine the police hearing about that and coming to his home and knock on the door and say, may Professor Steinberg come to some questions? And his wife goes and comes back, asks him, and he says, come on, I have an experiment tomorrow. Tell them that I'm not at home. She comes back and says, I'm sorry. Professor Steinberg says that he is not home. Do I feel that here nature is doing something similar? That is, they say that they are not entangled, but this entanglement, this claim that they are not entanglement is due to entanglement. This is another version of the quantum liar paradox, to which we have some other versions. And of course, I should say that Yakir would oppose the very term quantum liar. Nobody is lying. You don't understand. These are two informations coming from the past and from the future. If you want to understand them, and here we are trying now this is something which Yakir is working on. For the last week, we have been fortunate to hear his treatment, his radical treatment of the double slit experiment, in which he says that information coming from the future actually brings the particle back to what people aspired to, that is, having the particle taking one trajectory, plus something very interesting, something very intriguing, like the modular momentum going through both ways. In this case, it is very likely that the modular momentum is involved in a more subtle way. So this is an example of how actually inexhaustible is TSVF in deriving phenomena which may look surprising or strange, but within this way of thinking are very natural. Which leads me to a paradox, or apparent paradox, which you all know about, which involves the three boxes. You take a particle, split it between three boxes. So this is the pre-selection, and then you take a post-selection, you wait for this result, and then you can claim something very, you can make the following claim. You have now boxes number 1, 2, and 3, and you can say this group of particles which you chose, have you been opening box 1, you would certainly find the particle in box 1. Have you been opening box 2, you would certainly find the particle there. And have you been opening the third box, you would find something even more strange, and here comes this odd value. Which now means, how can you do that? Actually, this is a counterfactual. So there are a few ways that you can do it. One is to use weak measurements, and I applaud the straightforward way in which Ephraim dealt with people who try to trivialize this. We were thinking recently about the case in which you put an AB, you put a solenoid between two of the boxes, and then you see that actually the phase which changes, this phase of odd values, is just changing like normal values, which again makes you understand that there is something real going on there, and not just playing with the numbers. But there is another way, which we heard Yakir himself saying. And you know, Yakir always said that everything that you deal with in according to the two-vector interpretation can equally be understood in the one-vector. It is the two-vector only adds or makes you see things that without it you're not likely to see. So what if we actually do it one vector, and then we don't make the post selection, but open one of the boxes? Apparently, you ruin the experiment. You find it, and then trivially, you either find it in the first, or in the second, or in the third, and then you recombine the three thirds of the wave function and get your result. Interestingly, in those cases in which you opened box number 1 and found the particle there, or open box number 2 and found the particle there, these are the cases which will give you the selection, the post-selection, which you usually use in order to retrodict. So what happened here? Were we merely ruining the experiment and robbing it of its interesting content, or something else? And I would like to propose that actually this is the case in which Yakir didn't like this. When Einstein heard about de Broglie's discovery treatment of the particle as a wave, he wrote to Langevin, "Your disciple has lifted the margin of a great veil." And why do I think that another part of this veil is lifted now when we look at this apparently trivial way of looking at the three-box experiment? Because I go back to thoughts which may have to do with the previous talk. Many years ago, I wrote an article which was completely qualitative. I pointed out a connection between three prohibition laws, which somehow seem to be connected in a very interesting way. So you have the quantum mechanical uncertainty principle, you have the relativistic prohibition on velocities greater than light, and the thermodynamic prohibition of entropy decreasing in a closed system. It turns out that if you violate one of them, it leads to violations of the others. If you are capable of measuring both position and momentum, you can transmit information through the EPR and violate causality. If you have things going that you can see in real time, not with circumstantial evidence as you do in the usual EPR. But if you do it in real time, say you have tachyons, then there will be some reference frames in which you will see the second law of thermodynamics being violated. Suppose that I have a torch which sends many tachyons, and then I lit the walls. There will be some reference frames in which people would say, look, so many molecules from the wave emitted tachyons, which converged back into this torch. So in some very interesting way, now we should not be surprised in light of the Bekenstein-Hawking radiation and similar phenomena, but in some way, we see that the three great theories of physics, of the three great foundations of physics, somehow conspiring, despite the fact that they seem to be in some conflict, when it comes to a crucial experiment, then they seem somehow to conspire in order not to violate one another, which is interesting. But is there a way to go deeper into it? Some 10 years ago, when I was in this institute, I believe it was in this floor, in which I found a very brave theorist who was thinking about this very problem. Anthony Valentini asked about why is it that indeed there seems to be such a profound connection between these two prohibitions? And he proposed the following. At the beginning of the universe, at the Big Bang, there was non-locality much stronger than the one that we see. So much so that actually violations of causality occurred there as a matter of fact all the time. Then came something to these something akin to heat death at the particle level, such that all those particles became so scrambled that you cannot see the violation of causality. You cannot see this blunt sending of information faster than light. And of course, you cannot use it. But it is still there. It is happening there, but only covered somehow by a kind of censorship, which perhaps is not very different from other kinds of censorship that we see. Again, these theories give you a picture in which you cannot see such an outrageous thing as signals going faster than light or entropy decreasing. Then he suggested, and I wonder whether he still thinks so, that there should be some procedures in which you can once again extract this minority of particles and somehow collect them in order to do all those things which today are considered impossible, say having computers with greater power or even sending signals faster than light. Seems very far-fetched, right? But why do I think that actually this is what the three boxes experiment is telling us? Is it possible that every time that Alice and Bob are making an ordinary EPR experiment, in some cases, for example, in those cases here in which Alice opened a box and found a particle there. This is the first box that she opened. You don't know whether it was just by chance or because this belongs to the group which will give you the right post-selection. Do I make myself clear? Imagine that I come from the future. Imagine if I come that I come from the future. I'm a prophet, and I'm telling you, I can tell you, this particle is going to give you this post selection. Then what you can do is to give the boxes to Alice and Bob, and then they can transmit signals and just violating causality and doing what we think to be impossible. It is only because there are no prophets that only at the end we say, oh, you sucker, you could now get a Nobel Prize for violating causality, but it's too late now, all the evidence that you have is circumstantial. It's again this damn photon which did na-na-na-na-na-na, but then once you understood by circumstantial evidence what it was doing, it was too late to exploit it in real time. So actually, this is the kind of tip of the iceberg that I think that is now beginning to emerge. That is that as strange as quantum mechanics is, something much stranger is beneath there, in which quantum mechanics is only the tip. Let me comment.
Yes, this, of course, this is a story. So what Yatir was proposing is, and may I liken it to something which Dirac did when he got, Yatir sometimes say, don't trust the mathematics too much. Fine, but don't trust it too little, I would argue. Here was a case of a young man who saw that the equation describing the behavior of the electron gave him sometimes the plus sign, and then he said, well, he chickened out a little and said it's the proton. But later, Anderson discovered just what people feared most, which was the electron. In this case, when you get something which looks like negative probability, then you can, of course, dismiss it, what people used to do so far. Or you can say, if the formalism is telling me this amazing thing, let's try to assign this negative value to something. Of course, we will not do it to the charge if this is an electron, but how about to do it to the momentum or to the mass? And then it is possible that what we are doing actually, that in real time, what is happening to in our experiments is something far more amazing than and far more outrageous than ordinary quantum mechanics, but it is by some kind of censorship that we cannot see it. Let me make one more comment, which did not go into presentation. Can we have, or am I going to use quantum erasure or right? Right. And actually, it has something to do with erasure. For many years, I've been following Hardy's work since those happy days in which he was doing his PhD with squires. And you know, after we Lev and I found out the interaction for the IFM, so then along came Lucian and said, well, why don't you do two IFMs like this? What is so interesting in IFM, which we found, but is almost trivial, is that we have exchanged the roles. Rather than the detector measuring the photon, it is now the photon who is measuring whether the detector can click or not, and which gave us those surprising results. Then said Hardy, why not make the detector itself quantum mechanical, or the bomb itself quantum mechanical, and then you're going to get something something really even more interesting. And indeed he did. Let this be an electron and this a positron. And again, Gedanken. So don't ask me about technicalities. But then, if this will be, I like this to be the C and this the D, just for symmetry, then there will be cases, of course, you know that if they meet, they annihilate, and you select for the cases in which they do not annihilate. Then you get all kinds of interesting results, the Hardy paradox, which for Yatir was, for the TSVF was really a festive, because it was an opportunity for the TSVF to show how two informations give interesting results, as intriguing as they are. It was just upon my visit now, which I asked Lucian whether we were not missing something all the time. We were selecting for the case in which there was no annihilation. That is, a gamma photon coming here and presumably, of course, you want to know, gives a click. Now, in a work which Eli Cohen and I did, we simplified it a bit, and then we have this electron and this positron, and now when they split, we don't recombine them, but we let the electron cross the two arms of the positron and wait for the result. So we are going to get annihilations. But in some cases, we get no annihilations, which means the two detectors, which could be far away here, will fail to detect the two gamma photons. Now leave this state, do not recombine them. What you get here is that in this case, the electron has collapsed, is now resides only on the right side. The positron remembers nothing of the situation. It has returned into its superposition, which seems to defy a famous law proposed in 1666, right, there is an interaction. Out of this interaction, one of the particles one of the parties emerged, changed, the momentum of the electron changes, because if you do interference, you will see that its momentum has changed, but the positron has not changed. It remains oblivious of what happens, which is why we call this this effect quantum oblivion. You understand the situation? You find it intriguing. We argue that this is what underlies IFM, as well as quantum erasure, as well as the AB, as well as several other intriguing phenomena. This is a very basic thing in which when two wave functions interact in an asymmetric way, such that one part of one wave function interacts with the entire wave function of the other part, then such interesting phenomena exist. And there is a very brief time in which, in ordinary measurements, we refrain from completing the measurement, such that we remain ignorant of the position of the positron, and this is how we get a measurement. This is a kind of interaction-free measurement, and we argue that this is what happens in all ordinary interaction-free measurements, whereas instead of the positron, we have the pointer of the detector or of the bomb, which is in a superposition, and then there is, and this is important. What you have in an ordinary measurement is a sequence of weak measurements, which then go, there is a smooth continuum there, which go on, and you wait some nanoseconds in the ordinary cases, because you don't want a weak measurement. Most people are not interested in weak measurements, right? So once you had this thing in which you did not have these annihilations, you remain ignorant of the position of the positron, and then you know that its momentum has either changed or not. This is what we are usually doing. But the interesting thing is these photons, because now I argue that we have something, an interaction-free measurement of a very intriguing kind, which was there all the time and we didn't observe. In the ordinary IFM, you have a particle which is superposed. It either went this way or that way. By the very silence of the detector, you know that it did not go this way or that way, which is intriguing. In this case, you have a photon which you don't know whether it was emitted or not emitted. These detectors can be very far away. So a photon, should I call it a photon? It's not a virtual photon. Shall I call it a counterfactual photon? Kind of ghostly entity, goes all the way, which can be very long, a long time, come to the detector, and then the detector measures whether it has been emitted, whether it has been born at all or not. And in many cases, it tells you that it tells the result is that the photon was never emitted. This is, again, the Lyar paradox, which you have. You have two systems which apparently did not exchange anything between them, but something was exchanging, because actually if we turn this into an EPR, we would get the quantum Lyar paradox, as we told you, which means that our universe seems to be a much more interesting place, even in terms of thermodynamic calculations and all other considerations. Consider an atom, radioactive or excited, somewhere in empty space, alone. Apparently, it is not interacting with anything. Not so. If there is a time uncertainty about the alpha, beta, gamma particle, or a photon which it emits, then zillions of other molecules in the distant universe, in the future, keeps measuring it and become entangled in ways that it is really hard to imagine, which means that such conditional particles and such conditional interactions are orders of magnitude overwhelmingly much more than the ordinary ones, which gives you an interesting kind of universe about which I don't know to say really much. So what I want to say is the following. Yeah. Sometimes you do want to trust the mathematics. Here is a work by Cohen and Brodusch. I guess Eli will expand on it a little on his talk on Thursday. to the effect that indeed those strange, those odd values like negative momentum or too high momentum or too low are actually part and parcel of every measurement. They just occur temporarily and then either strengthened or canceled by the next stages, by the next weak stages of the strong measurement, such that at the end they give you the, now you call it the normal quantum of either click or non-click. But something very interesting is happening in between, in which much more, much stranger phenomena occur, and then in order to give you finally the result that you want. I think I said pretty much, and it's time for the questions. How do you translate this beautiful verse from Psalms? Days may you add to the days of the king, his years multiply like generation to generation. So I want to thank Yakir for being the source of inspiration to so many people. May I say, he inspires us to aspire and sometimes to perspire. So, you know, we think that nature conspires in order to give us all these things, but it is only humans which conspire. Nature probably has a theory from which all these theories that we now know somehow stem, and it is we who aspire to find them, and this is somewhere in that huge iceberg which we are now revealing under the quantum tip. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. So we have time for questions.
Ellie. Thank you very much for the fascinating talk. The issue Boris and I brought to the front in our gather was the interplay between non-locality and uncertainty. This interplay which makes us preserve causality. So I guess Yakir would talk about that tomorrow and in the day after, and this is in fact what stands behind your Bell measurement. And I guess what I'm trying to claim is that even below that, there is a coherent sum of positive and negative weak values, sometimes leading to a counterfactual. But this counterfactual has a more rich structure than a mere null result.
So let me see if I understand you correctly. I'll reformulate what you said and see whether I was uncautious, because it's very exciting what you say. Sometimes we get IFM, which means that there was no event. And then we marvel, how come that a non-event leaves traces, causal traces, as in the IFM? You have a you have a bomb which could explode, but did not explode. And just by the fact that it did not explode, or let me take another example. Suppose I took the receptacle of the detector out of the wall. So it is not going to click, right? Then you're not going to change the interference. Now you put it back. It again did not explode, but now the D detector clicks. And then you say, I can't understand it. How could just the possibility of something happening leave a trace? This is not something which happens in classical physics, and this is what you and I were aspired to study in the oblivion effect. Now you say the following. Actually, when you think that there was no event, take what seems to be a very rare case, marginal case, which the TSBF discovers. Under special pre and post selection, you find things which seem to indicate negative momentum. And then, if I understand you correctly, it looks like it is not that rare. In all those cases in which you had no event, actually there was a combination of positive and negative momentum, which gave you this result.
I was just returning to the mathematics. You showed that the expectation value is just the sum of all weak values with the appropriate probability. So I guess this is something you could say.
And would you say that the realization that there are so many kind of ghostly particles just with us actually strengthening this way of thinking? Here you have a case in which back reaction, there should be a back reaction, is happens and then unhappens. May I say that? Something is happening and then unhappening.
Maybe you can continue this bad experience.
Oh yes, this was what I was afraid of. Further questions?
More questions?
Would you like someone to attack this wonderful guy?
Please do.
Well, Yakir Aharonov has a paper in which he says that the Bell inequalities have nothing to do with non-locality.
We are again at the realm of the broad look that Yakir gives you. Here you go again every time you mention Bell's inequality. May I still voice my beg to differ and say the following. Yakir cherishes free will more than anything else, I would say, in physics. And this is something that you cannot take from Bell. Bell is the person who for the first time introduced free will when he asked Alice and Bob, choose at the last moment which measurement you want to perform. Then when you compare it, you see that it is the free decision of two humans which actually prove to you that something went on non-locally. Yakir told me that it was there all in the formalism all along. Fine, but not everybody can just see from the formalism what Bell took. So I beg to differ. I think that Bell's discovery is very profound and adds a lot to the TSVF. Please do.
There is a difference between the non-locally.
Please speak up.
Just in super quantum correlation between a Bell experiment. And they are obviously there.
Wait. What do you mean they are obviously there? Wait a minute, let me make a comment. If I apply classical probability theory to the Bell experiments, okay, then I have a non-local theory. But if I do quantum mechanics from beginning to the end, then I find that certain elements of physical reality are not real, that everything is local. Because after all, quantum field theory is local. And this is a paper that Aharonov and one of his friends published. Man, your friend, right?
No,
if you are willing to think about big values that are not real, or they depend on the future, you can actually show that without violating free will, you can get all the position of bed, without assuming there are truly non-local effects, like assuming that each pair of electrons that come out, each pair of electrons comes out, not only what you're going to measure, even though you haven't made a decision yet what you're going to measure. So, why don't we wait for this? This is going to be discussed carefully, the issue of screen reading, in the context of screen post reaction. It's one of my views.
Okay.
Can we only agree about this, Marlon? That you can make the, I believe there is another question. So just to answer this, that in all these cases, we can make the following counterfactual. Has Alice been choosing another sigma X rather than sigma Y or sigma Z? Then Bob's up would be down. Can we make this counterfactual?
Well, I would like to make a strong statement. Good talk.
Good. Yes, okay, please.
You want to take the question here for my understanding, and you were taking the actual measurement together very much with Bell and other things. I wasn't entirely clear how you can make this connection precise, because there's one argument that I always find stands out a bit in the actual measurement, which is particles either there or not, and you don't have the complementary properties. For me, in optics, is always a little bit annoying, because you can have superpositions, particle, non-particle. How do you make this argument really either similar to Bell or the other way around, Bell more similar to particle or no-particle arguments?
First of all, let's take what is obvious in the two-state vector formalism. Two wave functions coming from Bell and from Alice go to the past. So I think that this shows you that what appears to you non-local in three dimensions becomes local in four dimensions once you allow this part. About how something happens and unhappens in order to give that, you caught me unprepared. I would have to assume what a different interpretation, that of Kramer, the transactional interpretation, would invoke in such a case. He would say that this interaction would go more than one time, sometimes with negative energies being exchanged. This you will find in his classical 88 paper, which I find interestingly similar to Wheeler and Feynman's classical idea of negative interference canceling odd results, and which I argue, I don't know if many people will agree with me, that something similar we were finding now in the TSVF, with events happening and unhappening, or odd values being exchanged more than one time. But I still owe you an answer coming in a few years, and I hope to have a better answer to that.
Okay, so after we thanked Abby, I've got two announcements. So let's thank Abby for that.